I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast. On today's show, we are excited to have the Dr. Deborah Kaysen join us. Deb is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. And she's going to be talking to us about post-traumatic stress and substance use co-occurrence. Really excited about this episode.
Deb Kaysen, welcome to the show. We're excited to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. We're very excited about this, and thank you for your time. We like to start our conversations typically hearing about our interviewees' training experience. So could you tell us a little bit about your training?
Sure. How far back do you want me to go?
as far back as you want people to know, I suppose.
Sure. So I am the product of the scientist practitioner model. So my mother is a dynamically trained private practitioner, she's got a PsyD. My dad is an MD PhD. So wow. He is a biochemist and nephrologist. And so then you get me. I knew I wanted to be a psychologist, but much more research oriented than mom. I went to undergrad at Tufts and then got a job at NIH. And at that time, I thought I wanted to work with schizophrenia. And it became clear to me at that same time, I was also doing work around women's health and that I wanted my graduate training to bring together my interest in research with my passion about improving women's health. And so when I applied for graduate schools, I specifically looked for graduate programs with that ability to make that transition. I was one of Patricia Riesick's graduate students at University of Missouri, St. Louis, where I got my PhD in clinical psychology. And then I matched for internship at University of Washington. As I got towards the end of my internship, my family announced to me that they were done with the witness relocation program that is an academic trajectory and said, we're staying in Seattle. You know, we had a bit of a Tim Gunn moment. They're like, you make it work.
So, regardless of where you go, they were staying in Seattle.
They were there. Exactly. They're like, you know, you've got a basket of things and you're going to make your career out of it.
Right.
And so I applied for postdocs solely in the Seattle area, which is always a bit of a challenge. You know, when I work with trainees now, I say you can either be rigid about what you want to do, or you can be rigid about geography, but you're going to have problems if you're rigid.
Oh, yeah.
So I applied pretty broadly and I thought I was going to get a specific postdoc that I didn't get for good reason. The person who got it is fabulous. He's a friend of mine. But what it meant is that the traditional PTSD postdocs, there weren't a lot in Seattle and I didn't get one.
Yeah.
And so Mary Larimer, who is an incredible scientist in the addictions field and is also quite possibly one of the kindest human beings on the planet, was supervising me clinically at that time on our outpatient rotation. And she said to me, you know, if you want to take that F32 that you've started that's looking at cognitive processes and PTSD, and if you can work addictions into it, I will sponsor you for an F32. You have 6 weeks before the NIH deadline.
It's tight.
It was super tight.
Yeah.
And I knew a little bit around the field of the overlap between PTSD and addictions, but was not. It was not my my main expertise.
So was this sort of your first foray into addictions?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. So I did a lot of reading. Mary and I pulled that grant together in 6 weeks. It was a lot of sleepless nights. Yeah. And, you know, bless her heart, as an amazing, amazing mentor, she pulled probably as many all-nighters as I did getting that grant out the door.
Wow.
And it funded on the first try.
Wow.
That's really impressive. Yeah.
So it's luck and hard work.
Yeah.
But that's how I wound up in the addictions field. So I stayed at UW for my postdoc, and then continued and transitioned into faculty.
Wow. And then you've been at Stanford for a handful of years now. Is that right?
A handful of years. I was at UW for 17 years. Oh. And I moved to Stanford August 2019. So right before the pandemic. So that
you've
also
barely been there.
Barely been there.
Yeah. That's a challenge. That's a challenge. Yeah. At least you got like a 1 year ish.
Not even six months. That's 6 months. And we can talk about the pros and cons to changing jobs during a pandemic.
Yeah. I'm very
as well as moving houses.
Yeah. Oh, I did it too. I did it. I moved from Brown to Colorado State, where I'm at now.
Yeah.
Last summer. Yeah. During the middle of it all.
Yep. It's been an interesting ride.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of lessons I think in there about, you know, you had an expectation for a specific postdoc related to PTSD, and you didn't get it, but have actually developed probably a more profound area of research, that then maybe might have been possible otherwise, which
without
I think,
a doubt.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool thing to hear. And I think as a trainee right now, and you know, for other people listening, it can be really hard, I think, to see an opportunity go by and you miss it, and then think that, you know,
that's it,
the end of your line of research or whatever. So it's always good to hear that, and you know, brings hope. But that's really what we want to talk about today. You can comment on that. Sorry, it looks like you had something to say.
Yeah, well, I think there are two things. So I actually tell trainees now, you know, I was on our internship faculty at UW. Yes, I still say our, I apparently am still a Husky in some ways at heart. but I tell our interns that I was that person who got their postdoc on the last day of internship. Mm. And I tell them that on purpose, because when people don't have things aligned, it can feel so painful. And also, if you look at someone's CV, you see something that looks neat and organized and planned. And that's not always how it is. And that doesn't predict anything about how smart you are, what a good scientist you are, or what your career is going to look like long term.
Yeah, absolutely. And often that CV is, you know, developed post hoc to look that way. So so that's a great point. Yeah. And we really want to focus in on this career that you have built today, and you know, our conversation specifically talking about trauma and PTSD and substance related disorders, and probably primarily alcohol use disorders today. So do you think you could tell us a little bit about that is kind of what brought you to study the overlap between PTSD and alcohol use disorder. But can you tell us a little bit about that project and sort of how that developed?
Absolutely. And I was already interested in PTSD and substance use. In grad school, I was doing a lot of our clinical interviews for some of Patty's research studies, and noticed, you know, we'd be partway through a CAPS assessment, so the clinician administered PTSD scale, and people would say, you know, can we take a break? I really need a smoke. So at that time, my interests were more around PTSD and tobacco use and how people were using tobacco to regulate affect. So those clinical observations had already fed in. I also had treated a few people as a graduate student who had PTSD and alcohol use disorders. So it wasn't a complete non sequitur, but it wasn't where I really thought my research was going to be. The first project, so the F32 project, was looking at cognitive processes underlying PTSD and alcohol use in the immediate aftermath after trauma. And so some of my early publications, both off of Patty's data and my own, were trying to understand how these disorders reinforce each other. So testing self-medication hypotheses, looking at alcohol expectancies versus some of the trauma processes, And how do we understand those pieces? Drinking motives. Why do I think I drink?
Yeah.
That led into an R21 grant that was trying to test those same questions, except with college women, in many cases, a little bit sooner in the process, and really trying to see, is it about trauma exposure or is it about PTSD? Hmm. How do the disorders influence each other? So, and then that's led into treatment research.
I think that's so interesting, right? Like that whole, there's a very interesting timeline that kind of unfolds in that process that I think a lot of your work has kind of allowed us to understand even more. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about maybe some of the underlying mechanisms that are at play here, and maybe how this kind of what it is basically a reinforcement loop, right? Where each condition like promotes the other, right? And through over time, they kind of become even more in sync with each other. And so I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about how that process kind of unfolds.
Yeah.
And
in addition to that, could we hear a little bit about the epidemiological data or co-occurrence of these, like what are the rates, I guess, of co-occurrence of these two phenomenon and how does that sort of play out? And then in addition to, you know, asking about the mechanisms.
Absolutely. So they co-occur quite frequently. So the piece with PTSD, first of all, just kind of broadly, is PTSD is a very friendly disorder. It shows up with other comorbidities far more frequently than it shows up all by itself.
Yeah.
In terms of how often does it show up with alcohol use or substance use, that data is a little more nuanced. Some of it depends on where are you pulling your sample from? And also, are you looking at men versus women? There's some interesting data around the gender piece, where for men, they appear to be at high risk for alcohol use disorders, sort of regardless of PTSD. Men are just at elevated risk. PTSD doesn't add that much more to what is already high risk. But for women, PTSD really seems to confer added risk for alcohol use disorders. I believe the rates are about a two-time higher risk of PTSD for women, or excuse me, of alcohol use disorders for women in response to PTSD. The other challenging piece is that it depends on what you're doing in sorting out other substance use disorders. So are you talking about PTSD and just alcohol use, or PTSD and alcohol and a bunch of other stuff?
Right.
And then it gets really sticky. Tracy Simpson, who I do a lot of research with, did a very, very elegant paper that was also a tremendous labor of love, looking at some of the NASARC data, where she really tried to tease apart what is PTSD and alcohol use versus PTSD and alcohol and other stuff versus PTSD with nothing, alcohol use with nothing. And looking at what are the impacts of those different comorbidity patterns on outcomes. I think sometimes when we talk about the PTSD and alcohol use literature, because we ignore other substances, it may be telling something that's a little misleading. In that project, we found that the group that was really having the hardest time were the folks who had PTSD and alcohol use and were also using other substances, that, you know, polysubstance group.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think that, you know, we talked about this a couple episodes ago with someone, Noah, but I can't remember who, but it's really rare, I think, for people to use just one substance as well. So sometimes we might be doing ourselves a disservice by just thinking about one.
That's right. Yeah. You know, and it gets sticky. And when we try to answer those questions, you know, we want something that's a neat answer.
Right.
And people aren't neat. But the short answer to your question is, you know, in general, at least if you look at the early research by Kessler, About if you look at 100 people with PTSD, about 52 of them will have an alcohol use disorder. So that's sort of like your simple, ignoring gender, ignoring polysubstance use. That's sort of your simple answer. Based on the NASARC paper that I was just talking about that came out in 2019, what we found was that 68% of people just had PTSD with no substance use disorders. And we found 17% that had alcohol use with no other drug use. 8% had PTSD with alcohol and drug use. And then about 7% had PTSD with just other drugs. I think those are the numbers.
So pretty high prevalent. And it sounds like some of the, there's wide variability, at least to some degree, depending on samples and all of that. And maybe even time, maybe those were just far apart in time.
Right, and that's lumping together people, right. Right. Well, yeah. And a lot of that is lumping people together too. So I think the other question that we talked about is where is somebody in a trajectory?
Right.
Right. Are you looking at people who are soon post-trauma exposure? Are you looking at people who were using substances before the traumatic event?
That is so important. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so a lot of my research has been trying to tease that apart. Right. So, you know, if somebody is already using alcohol, for example, they have a higher risk of sexual victimization and re-victimization. So substances can increase, that's sort of what we call the high risk hypothesis. Hmm. Substance use can increase your risk of experiencing trauma. At the same time, if you experience a traumatic event, it can then alter your use.
Yeah, which is how you get this kind of self-perpetuating dynamo, right? Where it has, you know, multiple entry points, but once you get into the cycle where both of those things are co-occurring, they kind of reinforce each other in pretty meaningful ways.
That's right. Exactly
and,
right.
And you get, I mean, and there are individual, like, you know, pharmacological effects of different substances, but in general, right, substances are, you know, thought to kind of help down regulate some of the intensity of the negative emotional and re-experiencing kind of components of, you know, traumatic stress and PTSD and related disorders. Right. And then, you know, and the thing is about substance use even more than alcohol, but alcohol too puts you into some high risk situations mm-hmm. where experiencing a traumatic event is increased in likelihood, like a, you know, drug deal, for instance, can go sideways on you pretty quick. And then spontaneously what turned into a normal Tuesday night turned into, you know, a traumatic event, you know, and in alcohol with intoxication and things like that also place people at a greater risk. And so you kind of get this perfect storm where there are differences in likelihood, depending on a person's entry point, but once they get in there, right, it tends to be really reinforcing for each other, which is, you know, one of the reasons why I think in frontline treatment, you hear a lot about this intersection, at least. So I came in the door as a person who worked in frontline treatment before I went to graduate school. So I worked in like a 28-day residential, you know, and you hear a lot of things kind of anecdotally getting thrown around, I think, in those spaces. And one is like the ordering effects, like, oh, a person, you got to go get recovery before you can work on your traumatic stress. Or, you know, I hear a lot of people say like all people with substance use disorder have traumatic experiences in their past that we need to deal with, and trauma-informed care becomes this kind of nebulous word that gets thrown around a lot, I think. And so I was wondering if you could maybe talk to us a little bit about what the science tells us about that, given so much of your work is kind of focused on treatment development for this co-occurrence, and maybe talk a little bit about some of the ordering effects that are at play here. Are there, you know, is there a specific order that we're supposed to do this that the science tells us, or?
No, that's my opinion. So, you know, one of the things that's always fun about doing something like this is talking about the data that's not yet published. Mm. So Tracy Simpson and I had a co-PI grant to look at exactly those kinds of questions, Noah, with people with PTSD and substance use, what are you supposed to treat first? It wasn't quite a first question, because if we were going to do that, we would have needed to do a double crossover design, which would have been beautiful, but I don't think we would have gotten funded for that.
Unfortunately, yeah, they don't do the fun stuff like that. Yeah,
I know. But what we looked at was cognitive processing therapy versus relapse prevention, because we wanted to understand, we didn't alter either therapy. So unlike some of the treatments like COPE, where relapse prevention, for example, has been built, baked into the PTSD therapy, this was, can you treat alcohol use disorders without changing CPT? And can you treat PTSD without changing relapse prevention? Because if the self-medication hypothesis is correct, it shouldn't matter. Right? Because you should be breaking that cycle.
Yeah, you should be decoupling them, right?
That's
and,
right.
And therefore, the system that is kind of the infrastructure in a person that's keeping this thing around should kind of disaggregate and thus fall apart, allegedly.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, we did think that each therapy would work better on its primary target than the other therapy. CPT should work better for PTSD. Relapse prevention should work better for substance use. But we thought that both would work on the secondary disorder as well. So what we found was not quite what we expected, but I think it directly speaks to the questions you guys are answering. What we found was CPT worked slightly faster on PTSD, but that both therapies reduced PTSD and both therapies reduced drinking. So CPT affected the PTSD faster. It did not affect drinking faster. And we had 1 year follow-up, and we found that both therapies had significant effects on both primary and secondary outcomes with really no big differences between the therapies.
That is a really important paper. That's going to be a really important one.
It's a monster paper.
I'm sure.
We are deep into revisions.
Yeah. I'm interested to know a little bit in how much, I don't know how much you could speak to this, but in the original cognitive processing manual, the 2007 edition, it has a section in the intro about substance use disorder. And basically it says, like, can you make an arrangement with them to not drink when they're doing the homeworks so they can have like an authentic emotional experience and all this kinds of stuff. And in the newest one, I think it's 2016, where they changed it a bit and they made it now optional for the imaginal exposure components, in that it has a little bit different take on it, but still basically says that like, we need to make an arrangement. So I'm curious what kind of arrangement was made, with the people on the study you're talking about.
So people, to enter the study, people had to be willing to reduce their substance use, but it was not an abstinence-based model.
Okay.
Unlike the original CPT research, people were included if they were dependent. They just needed to not be so dependent that we were worried that we were going to kick someone into withdrawal in a way that would be medically unsafe for them.
Gotcha.
What we did encourage people is we encouraged people to not avoid and to not use alcohol to avoid. But it wasn't a reason we would throw someone out. We did use breathalyzers. People were not allowed to participate in sessions if they were intoxicated, in part because we just really didn't think that they would benefit. So we would reschedule. But what we would do is we would target alcohol-related cognitions using the tools of CPT. Mostly around beliefs about alcohol to cope. I won't be able to do my practice if I don't have a drink. So we considered that to be fair game within CPT.
No, I think that makes total sense, right? And one of the foundational components, right, is like teaching people how to avoid avoidance.
Right.
Using your powers of avoidance for good. Right. And so to avoid the avoidance, right. And if you characterize alcohol use as an avoidance behavior, right. And the cognitions associated with it, kind of fit right into that. It sounds like it would be easy to integrate them in a meaningful way without having to do any kind of like COPE, for instance, which is relapse prevention, basically in prolonged exposure. Shout out Sudhi Back.
That's right.
Out of MUSC, exactly. Who've kind of put that together, where it, like, they're like, you know, substance specific sections to the treatment itself, mm-hmm. where in CPT that doesn't exist as it sits currently. Right. And so that makes total sense to me. And I think it would work really well. And I was curious, maybe if you could, just for the people who are unfamiliar with CPT, sure. talk a little bit about maybe some of the components to it and some of the kind of underlying framework, so that people understand a little bit about what we're talking about.
Absolutely. So cognitive processing therapy is one of the evidence-based treatments for PTSD. It's a 12-session therapy. It was originally developed for sexual assault survivors. It was originally developed as a group intervention, but has been adapted long, long ago also to be an individual therapy. It targets beliefs about the trauma. So it's predominantly cognitive. And the idea with the therapy is it targets two different things. Both, how did the person make sense of the event itself? What's the story they tell themselves about who was to blame? Could the event have been prevented in some way? So that piece about the trauma itself, and it works on processing the emotions around the event itself. The second part of the therapy looks at the lessons learned from the trauma, basically. So it specifically targets overgeneralized beliefs around safety, trust, power and control, esteem, and intimacy. It can include a written account about the event, but it doesn't have to. And more recent research is including that less and less over time.
Why is that?
There was a dismantling study that was published a number of years ago now, where it was one of those places where you don't get the results you always expect in research. Trying to answer that question of, you know, what do you need all of the pieces?
Right.
Is that account necessary to get that emotional processing? And what that study found was that CPT without the account worked equally as well by post-treatment. It actually worked faster. So they looked significantly better than folks who had the account by about session 4, and it had lower dropout.
Yeah, that's the key, I think, is that
it went, dropout piece.
The dropout piece, because when you look at the lines over time, they kind of converge at the end, but they just kind of like have an accelerated slope in the beginning for people who didn't do the account part, but it drops from about, what is it, like 28% dropout to like 8% dropout.
I think in that study it was 16%. So 16. The CPT without the account had about a 16% dropout, and with the account it was somewhere in the 20s, maybe 23%.
Yeah, so it drops down pretty markedly, and I think that's one of the things that people are probably most nervous about when we kind of line up cognitive process or any traumatic stress related intervention, right? It's like, we're going to do these trauma accounts, and they're like, whoa, right? Like prolonged exposure, for instance. Prolonged exposure even has a higher one.
That's true. You get to skip the anticipatory anxiety.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think it's actually not necessarily distress around the account itself. It's that fear of approaching the memory in that way. And so you get to skip that. And I think that's why you actually see that accelerated improvement as well, is you don't have to go through those sessions of going, it's coming. I'm super amped about that.
Which will stabilize some of the symptoms if you're doing a week-to-week kind of tracking, right? Or even make them increase, right? Like you kind of see this kind of sawtooth pattern oftentimes when I look at people I work with, where, you know, the week before it kind of spikes up and then it goes down after, right? And you kind of see that along the way. It allows us to bypass some of that stuff. And one of my favorite things about cognitive processing therapy is the just world belief framework, right? Which is that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. And then when a bad thing happens to a good person, usually people view themselves as good. We have to make sense of the senseless. And by doing that allows us to, you know, or it facilitates these kind of overgeneralized lessons that you talked about, and intimacy and power and safety and so forth, which are kind of maintaining factors. And I think that I think is a really helpful framework for anybody who out there who's interested in working or comes into contact with people who have experienced traumatic stress. Just kind of understanding that framework, I think, can be so helpful.
And one of the places sometimes people get tripped up is also folks where that they still may have that just world belief, but they have it in a different way. So you can think of the idea of things being fair, mm-hmm. everything happens for a reason, karma, right? Or people have had really bad experiences where they then see the event as confirmatory evidence that the world is unfair. That's still a just world yeah. belief. It's just a negative one.
Yeah. And all of that, I think, right, can facilitate people kind of getting stuck, right? Which is kind of one of the important frameworks around CPT, which is the idea that PTSD is a disorder of stuck remission, right? That people naturally kind of remit right. over time after they experience a traumatic event. And then people kind of get stuck in that process through time as they try to, you know, make sense out of what has happened. Right. And that kind of keeps them stuck. And then next thing I know, they find out that, you know, alcohol or substance use, hey, that really helps in the immediate sense. Right. And then kind of here we go with that kind of self-perpetuating system that kind of locks a person in even more to some of those kind of learned habituated responses to, you know, over hyperarousal and so forth.
That's right. You know, the other piece that we don't talk about as much that I think is important are the other kinds of drinking that happens though too.
Mm.
Right. So there are two places where we see it. Tracy and I have looked at, for folks who've got a more chronic pattern, the role of enhancement motives, right? So we often think about coping motives. I drink because, you know, I had, I mean, you can think about it. Like I missed a flight. Like we had a whole air, this was a number of years ago. I was trying to actually get to RSA and there was bad weather and our entire flight was canceled and we're standing in line trying to get rebooked. And what is everybody in that line saying? Let's go hit the bar.
Right.
Right. Coping motives, right? This is miserable. I'm going to have a drink to feel better. But we don't talk as much about enhancement motives.
Yeah. I'm so glad you brought this up.
Yeah. And so for folks who have had chronic PTSD, often what you get is emotional numbing.
Yeah. Anhedonia.
Right. Exactly. You get impairment in reward functioning. And so for folks like that, I think, and there is some data from one of Tracy and my daily studies, where what we found was that the relationship wasn't quite as strong, but we also found a relationship with enhancement motives. Mm. Some folks with chronic PTSD, they also are drinking to enhance. And so I think that brings up interesting questions around treatment. For whom does what treatment work better?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I come at substance use from a behavioral economics perspective, and we talk a lot about
very cool field.
Yeah, it's been great. I've been working with Jim Murphy. Had a blast for probably too long. I've been in graduate school for many years, but we talk a lot about, you know, how important alternatives are to you know, giving people alternative rewards to encourage reductions in drinking. And one thing that PTSD does, in addition to, you know, avoidance of negative feelings, is as you avoid those negative feelings, you stop seeing certain friends, you stop associating with groups of people that you used to that might remind you of the event. You go outside less. You might end up. So in addition, I think, to just trying to avoid those feelings, your alternatives are actually shrinking. You're sort of, the availability of rewards goes down as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a brilliant point. And so, like, in looking at the research that we've done with young college women, what we see are actually both processes happening simultaneously. And so it's interesting, like we did, David Hu did a really lovely job looking at the weekly cycle of drinking in our sample. And what he found was, like many college students, they drink a lot on weekends.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, we see that kind of scalloped pattern of drinking with our college sexual assault survivors. But then we also see coping motive drinking. Hmm. And so what we're seeing is a both and.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I'm wondering if you've done any work or if you're familiar with literature looking at the context of drinking. So social drinking versus solitary drinking as it pertains to PTSD.
Yeah, the population where we've looked at that the most is actually at a sample of young lesbian and bisexual women. And we were very curious because there's so little published that's empirical in nature around social context for their drinking.
Hmm,
so
yeah.
Sexual minority women are at higher risk for an alcohol use. And lesbian and bisexual women are at very high risk for sexual assault. Much, much higher than heterosexual women, much higher than gay or bisexual men. And, you know, there's a history in the sexual minority history of drinking in bars, right? So you also had the bar culture that certainly has had a long history of being a safe place, but also is a place then where you have higher risk. So we were curious about how people drank, and Anne Farley did a really wonderful job doing a latent class analysis, pulling out different profiles of drinking and context. And what she found is, yeah, there is a group where they're drinking in lots of contexts, but they also, that's the group that also is drinking by themselves a lot.
And,
right? And then there's a group.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were the group that also had the highest consequences associated with their drinking.
Yeah,
and then there's another group that's drinking socially, right? And they're going to bars, they're going to clubs, but they aren't having that same level of consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a pattern that holds true across, I think, the different kind of co-occurrences that exist. I think Cynthia Moore's paper, it's the 05 paper, Beyond the Keg Party, I think it's called.
Yeah. That's a great
paper. Such a great paper, classic. Anybody out there interested in cool papers, read Anne Fairley's paper and Cynthia Moore's paper here. But in there, they find, right, that people who drink in solitary contexts experience more consequences, right? That it's like emblematic of a process that's kind of facilitating consequences or is maybe even facilitating them, right? Like giving rise to them, something about solitary drinking, right? And that's a very interesting kind of thing to think about in the context of traumatic stress, in that as Sam talked about, right? Like the people slowly start to build smaller and smaller lives that are more and more controlled so that they can have increased safety and things like that. And with that comes these kind of solitary episodes, which it seems like those people kind of holds true across those two populations, which is pretty interesting, I think. Now, rarely do we get a nice pattern of results where it kind of coalesces across these different studies and different labs and different
but
populations.
This one does.
Yes, yeah. Which is really important.
We've got a PCORI grant that's going right now where we're looking at some different PTSD treatments. It's not an alcohol-related grant per se. But one of the members of our community advisory board described PTSD as a thief. It basically steals everything from you. And his quote was so profound about why he's putting energy into this project. And I think this example that you're talking about how it steals your ability to have connections with people. It keeps you trapped in your home. And even things that might be fun, you know, in small amounts, like drinking with friends, all of a sudden becomes something that's hurtful for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I imagine for someone who has PTSD and they're sort of starting to realize that, it can be probably fairly disheartening, but you know, you probably are prone to judge yourself, like that you're doing something wrong. I feel like it's so important to understand that your brain, your mind, you know, is trying to protect you. And trying to help you. And there's a pattern essentially of reinforcement that has gotten off track.
That's right.
But that it's trying to do something good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, Tracy's got a paper and I think the title of it is No Wrong Door. And we think about our findings from our CPTRP papers supporting that idea of no wrong door. Right. So, you know, Samuel, when you're talking about that concept, when our patients reach out for help and we say, no, you can't do this treatment, you have to do this treatment, that we are actually not being as helpful as we could be. If somebody reaches out and says, I need to treat the trauma first, shouldn't we pay attention to their sense about that? Or the opposite, somebody who reaches out and says, I got to do something about my drinking. Sure, I'll work on my PTSD, but I got to get my drinking under control.
And, you know, it strikes me that both of these disorders, if you want to call them a disorder, are in some ways disorders of control in some way. For the first step for someone to come into treatment and then you make the decision, you have control over which treatment they are going to get. I feel like it's almost therapeutic for them to be able to even have that option of control.
Yes. I agree.
Yeah. And motivation to change is so temporally specific, right? And nuanced that like, you got to thread the needle. You find somebody who's motivated for change right now on a specific thing to say like, actually, I think you should be motivated to change this other thing first, is not only incredibly invalidating, but missing out on like capitalizing on this like incredibly important moment in this person's life. And I think that's really a beautiful thing about some of the dismantling work and the ordering work that you've done, is that it allows us to kind of bypass some of that and say like, when a person walks in and they say, I'm interested in changing, and you say like, what? And then you do that. Right. And the idea is that like it, for instance, I've had this exact case that you described. And when I was in graduate school, a person came in and said, my PTSD is too much. It's stealing all these moments from me. And I want to work on it. I do not want to change my drinking. And they were drinking a great deal. And I was like, that makes sense to me, as long as we can make an arrangement, that where you're not going to drink during the homeworks or in session. Right. And that was an arrangement that they said they were okay with. And you watch their alcohol decrease through time.
That's right.
Kind of in a similar pattern as their traumatic stress symptoms. And eventually, you know, it just kind of didn't make sense for them anymore. It wasn't it wasn't the only solution that they had to this specific problem that they were experiencing. And I think that's really, I think the one of the big messages of the work that you do is that that we really don't have to force a person into this or that, and that we need to create more systems that allow us to do these things the way that the science says can be done and perhaps even should be done.
I agree. Well, and it ties exactly in with what Samuel was saying, right? Which is this idea that the person is doing the best they can with the resources they have on hand. Mm-hmm. And so for us to say, I'm going to take this coping strategy, this tool away from you, but I haven't put something else in place. You don't actually want to change that coping strategy, maybe right this second. Like, who's going to sign up for that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this cycle begins because the sort of landscape of reinforcement, you know, the water falls where the mountains lead, you know, into the streams. And so that's why. And if you do take that away, well, like, what is there to replace? Maybe you like you're saying, I think that's a really good point, is, you know, setting someone up to have an alternative when you start to move into these treatments is a really good idea as well.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting. We're going to have another study that should also play with some of these same questions of, you know, what do we do with comorbidity? We've got a study that is 5 participants away from being done.
Wow.
When COVID hit, and we are still waiting to be able to recruit our last spot.
Wow. So you had 5 people
left,
like in March, last March?
Last March. So it's a project with a rural Native American community. The community and the therapies are not a great fit for telehealth.
Yeah.
And so we have been on hold, just desperately wanting to be able to be providing services again. And it is heartbreaking. It's a community that's been hit so hard by COVID.
And that's a whole nother layer of traumatic stress
and, totally.
And historical trauma.
Historical trauma and all of those things. And I think what you just described is the true definition of being COVIDed, right? Yeah. Which is just like full stop. We don't full like, stop. Right. Many things have been COVIDed over the last year, but that
this one is
right. And it's so like the work that goes into working with those types of communities and doing, you know, community participatory research and things like that.
Yep.
Principles just take so much energy and are so important to those communities to be able to say like full stop. I'm sorry, we can't.
Yeah.
I mean, out of safety concerns, right? Like we don't want
safety else, for our participants, providers,
for the whole thing. It's so layered.
Absolutely.
And how unfortunate it is. And hopefully that with the, maybe
it seems think like we've there's got like, a green light to start soon.
I'm hopeful for you.
Well, yeah, even just holding on to a project, you know, it takes so much mental energy to sort of week in, week out, manage a project, and then for it to stop, and for a year, you're kind of just holding.
Every month, we get our progress report that says, "And we're still where we were, But for that project, we're looking at narrative exposure therapy.
Oh, I've heard a little bit about narrative
exposure.
A little bit about it. And specific, I was actually going to ask for you to tell us a little bit about how you've modified it to work with this specific population.
Yeah, very little for the specific population. So for this project, we're looking at narrative exposure versus motivational interviewing with skills training. The MI plus skills training, we did a fair amount of modifications, and I can tell you a little bit about that. So narrative exposure therapy was originally developed coming out of a number of different traditions. So it was developed to work predominantly with refugee communities, predominantly in low and middle income kinds of settings. It came from psychoanalytic theory, behavioral and exposure theory, and also testimonial work. So it was used, for example, in South Africa following apartheid. It was used in Rwanda following the Rwandan genocide.
Yeah.
The therapy is interesting in that it has tactile elements around oral storytelling, which was a really lovely congruent fit for the community we were working with. You have the person lay a lifeline of their entire life story, indicating both positive and negative life events. And then you do exposure for each of the traumatic events on the lifeline. But you also actually touch in and do a mini exposure around the positive events as well. So there are parts about it that are really lovely in terms of understanding the whole of one's life, thinking about people not just as a traumatic event, but as a person who also has strength. And those parts are really quite wonderful. There is no literature that it can be used via telehealth. None.
Yeah.
So, and if we had been mid-trial, we might have tried to figure out if we could do it, but with only five people left, it was a design nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. I did like a presentation for a class on narrative exposure some years ago. And nice. I remember being thrilled by it. You know, I think that they use flowers for positive events on the timeline, and then maybe a stone for negative events.
You've got a good memory, Samuel. That is exactly right. And then if you're working with perpetrators, you can use a stick for perpetration.
Oh, interesting.
Is it really interesting?
Yeah. Yeah. I loved it. I remember at the time feeling like the literature on it, like that it made a lot of sense to me, and that for the populations it was used for, that it would probably be very effective. I remember the literature being sparse and a little bit, not just very robust, I guess, when I did this.
Yep. And it's not, so ISTSS just finished our sort of review of treatment guidelines and our review of the literature.
Yeah.
And it came in as one that had like good support, but not quite at that like CPT, PE, EMDR level of research support. And some of it is the context where it's being tested. It's really, having done some of that work, it's really hard to do rigorous RCTs in some of those settings. It can be done, we've done it, but it is really hard. This will be, I think, one of the first US trials of narrative exposure therapy. So that's actually kind of fun. And there's not tons about whether or not it works for substance use. I believe there's like one paper on it being used for cats, but I don't know of much else. So it's going to be a fun project in terms of advancing the literature of how does this work. But it didn't need much in the way of modification for this, the community we were working with. There were some modifications we made in terms of specifically addressing how do you talk about historical trauma within the context of narrative exposure therapy. Right. And having to think through, do you do an exposure to that? What would that look like? You didn't directly experience it. So we had to think that through. And then there were some specific things we needed to include around how to work around death that were specific to this particular community's beliefs.
That makes sense.
So, with the MI and skills training, the MI, we used a manual that was already developed for a Southwestern tribe. And so it didn't take much to have it be a good fit. But our group did a really lovely job taking some of the skills training from relapse prevention and making it less academic in terms of languaging, weaving in cultural beliefs from the community we were working with around what are core values of this community and interweaving that into the work of the cognitive behavioral therapy piece. So that's actually quite nice. And it really de-emphasized written homework and had it be more like lived practice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's so crucial is to make it like benefit the community the best way possible. And if anybody's interested out there, Liz D'Amico has some really great work on MI adaptations for Native American populations specifically. If you're looking for a citation or a paper for people out there, hopefully this one will be coming out very soon, and then they could just go to there. But for anybody in the intermediate,
they're complimentary, right?
They're complimentary.
Like Liz's work is brilliant. There's also the canoe journey work that Alan Marlott's group did.
Oh yes,
Also a really nice example of how do we culturally tailor substance use treatment in a way that's congruent with the community's beliefs.
Yeah.
I think that's so important. And the narrative therapy sounds like it really capitalizes on some unique aspects. I think for me, there's a quote, I think it's from Kelly Wilson, that like people are sunsets to be appreciated, not problems to be solved. That really, I think leans into for me. And I think it really kind of emphasizes multiple pieces that we've talked about throughout this conversation, that like people are really doing the best they can with what they have. And they're more than just a traumatic event, although sometimes it can seem that way. Right. And that part of our role is to help people appreciate this kind of like rich tapestry that their life is constructed out of. And many positive things exist within that sometimes we're not paying attention to, or sometimes providers are just not paying attention to. That's what one of the things I really love about, whether that be advisory board work, like you've talked about with the quote from your group, whether that be community participatory research with communities like Indigenous populations and so forth, right? Or any of these types of approaches that it really allows us to kind of celebrate a person and understand where they're coming from in a way to help them get where they want to go in a very potent and meaningful way, which I think CPT allows for, which I think this narrative therapy really emphasizes. And I'm really, really excited to hear some of the work that you have coming up. Is there anything else you have coming up that you'd be willing to promo with us?
I'd be curious to hear what projects. I've always got like 12 different things going on. and I'm trying to think which ones are particularly in the substance use box. Because like some of the work I'm doing now, much of my work right now is just about advancing access to care, right? We have huge problems in the US with access to mental health care and substance use care. So, we've got a trial right now that I think is going to be one of the larger PTSD trials, and certainly the largest in primary care. We're looking at written exposure therapy. That's one that I'm excited about because it's five sessions. and it can be delivered, it can be trained with a much easier point of entry than a CPT or a PE. So we're comparing that to SSRIs in primary care settings. And then for non-responders, we're looking at what do you do with non-responders? If they got written exposure therapy and then you add in the SSRI, does that help? Mm-hmm. Right? If they got the SSRI, do you switch them to another medication or do you try exposure therapy? It's not addiction specific. However, I think it's got implications, right? So if we can do this in primary care, can we also do this, say, in an intensive outpatient clinic? Right? It's a lot easier to get somebody through a 5-session treatment protocol than a 12 or 15 session treatment protocol.
And you've demonstrated that at least for some of these other treatments. So we know that it's possible that if you can target these things and, you know, deal with some of the PTSD, reduce some of those symptoms, that you're probably going to be reducing some of the substance use as well.
That's right. That's exactly right. So I think that one's got a lot of promise. I'm excited about that. We are not excluding people. Really, the exclusion criteria are super minimal. So we should have data to also be able to tease out what happens with people's drinking. And we are also going to look at cannabis as a moderator. So we're curious. There is some data that cannabis may interfere with exposure processing. So we're a little curious about that.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I think it makes sense, actually. I think Marcel Bonmiller just published a paper in Plus One last week that said cannabis did not work for treating post-traumatic stress any more than placebo. And so that kind of lines up.
Send me that article because I want that article. I don't think cannabis is super helpful. I will send it to you straight away.
Marcel's kind of been on the front line for some of those things when he was at Palo Alto, and now I think he's in
industry.
And it said that it didn't do any better than placebo for traumatic stress symptoms, which is kind of counterintuitive in some ways from the framework that they were operating with, but is super intuitive based on the framework you just presented. Yeah. Right. That if it does actually interfere with processing some of those types of things, then it might actually not be super helpful. So that would make a lot of sense. That's a really important, I think, aspect to things that are going on here. And I think the increased access to care and kind of doing in these naturalistic settings are so important for the field. So much of it is kind of sterile and hyper controlled and things like that.
That's none of my research now. Somebody really
well, you know, research is on a spectrum, and it's helpful on a spectrum, I guess, too, you know, to the hyper control being good for finding the effect, not so good for actually disseminating. Especially in some of these populations where, frankly, the treatments don't trickle down very well.
That's right.
Like Native American populations, and frankly, there just needs to be culturally sensitive interventions that are put into place.
Absolutely.
It's really cool work that you're doing, and I know a lot of other people are doing work like this as well. Yeah. But you know, we didn't have that on the docket to talk about, and I'm really, really glad that it came up because I think it's such an important topic.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's funny. Like, I know there are people, and hopefully I don't offend anyone who is listening to your podcast, but I know there are people who get really excited about the horse race research question.
Yeah.
Right.
And which one's best?
Which one's best? And I'm like, I don't care. I actually don't. I genuinely don't care. When I have populations that I can't get to any effective treatment, that's what I care about, is what can be used in a setting that's realistic in that setting and that can help reduce suffering. That I care about. Like the you know, teeny tiny small effect size differences between perfect treatment A and perfect treatment B, for me, that's not interesting.
Yeah.
Circling back briefly to the marijuana conversation we were having. Michelle Bedard Gilligan is going to have answers to some of those questions about exposure therapy and cannabis use. She's wrapping up a R34 that's looking at a 6-session prolonged exposure and is recruiting people who are chronic cannabis users and people who are non-cannabis users to see how cannabis use affects exposure processing. So that's one I'd keep an eye out for.
Yeah, and that's nice because it answers a very specific and important empirical question and also sounds like it's a condensed.
Yes.
Which is, I think, so crucial. The briefness and like as I'm starting to get stuff up in my lab now, I'm trying to get like some community-based stuff up and running, and like the rolling admission component to it is such a huge barrier. Like, oh, there's nobody developed a thing where somebody could start every week. So you have to wait 12 weeks before you can start a treatment, right? Like that's not how things work in the frontline treatment space.
No.
Right. And so the key is getting a couch that fits your house, right? Not buying a house that fits your couch. Totally. Right. And
yes. So
I really love to hear, that's one of the things that's so cool about the work that you do is this dismantling components and understanding how can we like make it like just more adaptive for community deployment, I think, really, yeah. Right? Like, can we get rid of what happens if we get rid of this? What happens if we shorten it down? What happens if we adapt it this way? You lose some things in reviewers' eyes, perhaps, about control and things like that. But I think you gain so much more implementation and dissemination that it's so much more important, I think, in some ways than there's like super controlled RCTs and things like that to be able to really figure it out. I think that's such important work.
It's at the very, I mean, I think it's important work or I wouldn't do it.
But obviously also, biased, yeah.
Yeah. You know, but I'm still an active clinician. Mm. And so for me, you know, I keep a hand in clinical work in part because it keeps me honest, right? Yep. I have my own patients who don't respond or who are partial responders. I look at our wait list and how long our wait list is and have to think about, okay, how many people can I take on? And I deal with work RVUs and things that are unpaid clinical labor. And what happens when a clinic puts a requirement in that doesn't fit the reimbursement model in the clinic. Mm. And so it helps keep my work, I think, more attuned to what are going to be some of the barriers to adapting or adopting interventions as well.
Yeah. Well, and if I remember, your work in many ways started with a clinical observation. With smoking and in the middle of a cognitive interview. So that's the other piece is I think that it probably makes you a much stronger researcher because you are seeing what's going on in real time with clients. So,
and I get to try stuff out sometimes.
Right.
Like,
right.
Like right. I refuse to do a trial on a treatment I haven't played with.
Hmm.
Right. So like we started this PCORI grant and I went and sat through the training just like all of our other trainees. I sat through consultation calls and presented my cases and I picked up a bunch of written exposure therapy folks because I had to feel what the therapy was like before I could do it.
And you know, that should probably be a requirement for anyone doing a clinical trial that they have actually done the treatment. So So
I can get on board with that.
Doing that.
I'm a fan. And, you know, so like, you know, when we were thinking about the narrative exposure therapy in MI study, the way we adapted the therapy is going to create problems for dissemination, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it at the time and we made decisions to do it the way we did it for good reasons, but I think it's helpful to think about downstream consequences as well. So it's being delivered as a 2-hour intervention because that's what the community wanted and needed. 1 hour felt too short for them. And we knew we could get them in for about 6 sessions, but longer than that wasn't working. And so each session is 2 hours long. It's the same dose as our CPT trial that we did with the same community, but condensed.
Hmm.
Works great with our clinic that is within the community. We are also working with a community mental health clinic that uses much more of a traditional reimbursement model. It's a nightmare for them. Why? Wow. Because our reimbursement system will only really reimburse you for 90 minutes. Actually, it's really 56 minutes.
Wow.
And so all the rest of that time is free labor in the clinic's eyes.
Wow.
Right. So we don't think about those things if we don't work in those kinds of settings.
And I suppose this could come up in the take homes for policymakers, but I mean, that does sort of speak to the complex relationship between actual care that an individual person is getting and, you know, insurance.
Yep.
So,
and digital health, right? Yeah. So you asked about other stuff I'm having fun with. I'm doing some stuff in the digital health arena, and that is also a fun way to think about how do we get care to people?
Yeah.
How do we keep them engaged with it? But that reimbursement piece is going to come up as well. If we want to include coaches, for example, which is a really good way to keep people engaged with digital health interventions.
Yeah. I mean, with COVID, it's been the only way more or less to actually deliver it. And not that we'll always be like this, but I think probably for a little while still. And then I think just it opened up the option.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate this conversation. I've had a blast.
So fun. Me too. I've
learned a lot from you and Noah. Noah knows a lot about this topic as well. So thank you, Noah.
Yeah.
We want to transition into the take-home messages. Exactly. And so I'm wondering, what do you think the take-home messages, of your work are for people in recovery or, you know, given this specific episode, people who have PTSD?
Yeah. So what I would say is we have treatments that are really effective. We have a bunch of research on them, that it may seem very scary to take those steps, but I have seen time and time again, people be able to reclaim their lives. The traumatic event is a thief. It has stolen so much. And I would encourage someone who's thinking about trying to take these steps to go for it. That even though it's scary, find a clinician you trust, that you will take that journey with you and take the chance.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. What would you say to practitioners that are listening?
So for practitioners, I would say, listen to your patients.
Seriously.
That we're often so scared of causing a relapse that we forget that untreated PTSD is a predictor of relapse. And so thinking about the costs of withholding treatment as well as the costs of going forward. Often our fear around going forward gets in our way. And I would encourage people to stay with that idea of no wrong door. If someone says they're willing to do a type of therapy with you and there's an evidence base for it, so try it. As long as you're competent, as long as you don't have an overwhelming reason around safety to not go forward, that it's probably worth listening to the patient.
Yeah, that's great. What about policymakers?
Policymakers. I mean, I think there's a number of things that we touched on. You know, for policymakers, I mean, I think the first thing that I would say is to think about what behaviors you're clicking. PTSD is really expensive. PTSD and substance use is super expensive. They've got high rates of service utilization. If you have models that you reimburse that don't allow people to get better, that's probably not helpful.
Right? Yeah.
I think about a large HMO that shall remain nameless, where their model of care is either group therapy or monthly sessions. That's not a model that we found is effective. You follow the data, use models that help your patients get better. And that digital health is a way to expand care, I think, in likely a cost-effective way, but you've got to figure out a way for it to be reimbursable for clinician time. I think the last thing I would say to policymakers is, and this is also to our professional organizations, is state licensing rules create a major barrier for good care and continuity of care for patients. Right? PTSD doesn't know what state you're in. And if you're in a state that doesn't have providers or doesn't have enough providers, why restrict access to care for people who are trained how is that actually helping improve the mental health of your population?
Yeah. I love that point.
Yeah, that's such a good one. And hopefully with some of the interstate compact stuff that's going on with the digital health will pave the way for this. But if any policymakers out there are listening, the guiding star here, right, is patient care, right? That should be the guiding star. And so hopefully they'll take this point seriously. What would you say? Oh, please go ahead.
I was going to say PTSD is super expensive. It cost the US economy $3 billion a year. And that was in 2000. Right.
So
that's not even for these numbers.
That's not even
now.
Accounting for OEF. Oh, right. So like Afghanistan, right. The newest Iraq war, right, which started in 01, 02, right? And so the bend
and
of that is different.
That's right. And PTSD costs people about 3.5 lost days of work every month. So every month. So for employers, if you want to think about absenteeism, presenteeism, if you want a healthier workforce, push your healthcare providers, push your systems and insurers to actually adequately pay for people to get good treatment.
Yeah, because it sounds like after roughly 12 weeks, it can be a lot better.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow.
Exactly. Yeah, which is only a few short months compared to the longness of those dollars and lost time.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And then,
absolutely.
What would you say about underserved populations?
So I think for that, it's really got to be a dance. We've got to find ways to bring communities together with clinicians and researchers in a way that is actually mutually respectful and everybody listens to everybody else's wisdom. Right. It can't be a top-down academic model. We're used to saying, I've got a really interesting research question and I want to ask it with you versus tell me what problems you have and what your concerns are and how I can best support you. The different kind of dialogue. And for people from communities where they are looking for resources, you know, reaching out to academic partners is not a bad way to go. And if you don't like the partner you had, you don't have to stay with us.
Thank you so much, Deb. We really, really appreciate this. One final question for all the trainees like myself out there. How do we get to where you're at? What kind of advice do you have for us?
Be open to opportunities. Like have a plan, but be willing to flex the plan. Know that things are not going to go according to plan and that's okay. It doesn't mean something bad in the end. I think some of it is also listening to good advice when you get it and also knowing when you're not getting good advice and throwing it away and find good mentors. And you don't have to get everything from the same mentor, right? Find good people who are role models and who will support you and will cheerlead you. And you don't have to get it all from the same person, right? I've been blessed with many very good mentors in lots of domains. And so that's helped me get where I am.
Yeah, I think that's becoming a recurring theme is diversity of mentorship.
That's right. Get your mentorship a la carte.
Exactly. Don't get fixed price.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. I learned a lot. And it was a real honor talking to you for an hour.
Seriously. I'm such a huge fan.
Yeah.
Super fun. Yeah. And it was lovely. And I learned tons from both of you as well. So stay in touch and let me know what happens with each of your careers.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd be happy to.